Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we have a very special story. It's a real story. It's a real-life story about a 17-year-old by the name of Private Morris Rosen. Now, this is about when he was 17 years of age. This gentleman is a veteran. His wife decided that she was going to take on the challenge of writing her husband's story, his life story, and it's titled A Kid from Pittsburgh. Marion Rosen is his wonderful wife. Marion, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, you're in Southern California. Marion,
yes.
It took you over 15 years to put this story about your husband together.
It did. I started making notes. I didn't know where I was going with this. But I started making notes when we went to Europe for the D-Day 50th anniversary celebration back in 94.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I knew I had to do something with this story. I wasn't sure how it was going to work out, but I interviewed many of the men who were also survivors, men who were at the 50th anniversary. We met President Clinton and Hillary Clinton at a special function that they held to honor the veterans, and it was an eye-opener to me. I'm 17 years younger than my husband, so when World War II was happening, I was just a very small child, and I didn't really, I wasn't in it the way he was.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that the French people and the Italian people honored the veterans when they returned. You know, I started to put it together that this was something really big. And it's not the kind of thing that you generally read about in war stories. This is from the heart of this kid who didn't know what the heck he was doing when he first got into the war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you know, by necessity, he figured it out rather quickly because it was either that or not survive. And, of course, he was shot twice. So we're very fortunate that he's still with us.
Yes, we are. Now, I want my listeners to know about you. You've got a BS in English from Kutztown State University in Pennsylvania. You
mm-hmm.
had moved to California, received your master's degree from California State University, and you taught
right.
English and creative writing for 20 years in the Los Angeles
I
Unified
did.
School District. And then you yourself, after teaching creative writing for all those years, started your own writing career. You were hired by Macmillan McGraw-Hill to work on two textbook projects. But
That's
then
right.
in 1993, you wrote a mystery. It was called Death by Education, and mm-hmm. it currently has been optioned by Simon Lewis Productions, which is an Emmy Award-winning company. And this book also was published in Germany. And then in 93, you also put out a book called Don't Speak to Strangers, and it was
yes.
a real story. And Foreign Rights, excuse me?
I said it was a thriller.
A thriller,
suspense,
okay.
Suspense thriller, yes.
Yes, and that has been published in Sweden, Norway, Italy, and Germany. And then you wrote something called The Undertaker, and that was optioned by Saban Entertainment, and it was made for television movie in the 90s. And then you yourself hit a few rough bumps because you were diagnosed with not one, but two deadly cancers, and you wrote a book called Dance Like Nobody's Watching, which was published in 2002, and you've traveled all over the country talking about surviving cancer. I mean, it's not often you hear about two two cancers that a person has. Recently, I was talking to someone that had four cancers that were working in their body.
I had breast and ovarian cancer at the same time, which is a very frightening scenario in itself.
Right. That would be it. So here you are. You spend 15 years compiling all the information. You interviewed people. There are those in my audience that would love to be writers. When you were putting this information together, obviously you had to talk to your husband. I've spoken to so many vets that really don't want to talk about things. How were you able to get him to speak of some of the things that he did?
Well, that's why it was such a slow process, because he couldn't really just sit down and tell me this whole story. I had to get it in bits and pieces, and I would take notes. He was taken aback by the tape recorder. He didn't want to be recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the tape recorder away, and I just wrote in a little notebook with my pencil, and we talked, and we talked. And then, of course, I got to know many of the veterans who fought along with Maury, and I talked to them, too. And did a lot of research on my own, found out a little bit about the horrors of war, and decided that I didn't want battle tactics. That, that wasn't anything that I personally would be interested in anyway. But I wanted to know what was in the heart of this kid when he got into so much difficulty at the beginning of the war, and, of course, the dreadful things that happened to him as a teenager before he even joined the Army, and so on, as he got through to the point where he was involved with the liberation of a concentration camp.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't something that I was able to just get out of him in one sitting. We struggled. I struggled.
Mm-hmm.
For many, many sessions. And there were times that he just said, I can't talk about this anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd stop talking. And I'd have to wait.
Yes.
You know, a week, a month, until I could get into it again.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that I have discovered, that most people, unless they've experienced a war, unless they've actually had personal experiences that they have gone through, it's very tough to understand that the memories of the horrors that you see get burned into your mental tape so strongly, and you do everything you can to push them back. And I know when I've talked to veterans, they'll say to me, one in particular I'm thinking of at this moment, I can't talk about this anymore. I feel like I'm going out of my body. And it is not forgotten, and the emotions,
never.
The smells, everything are there, and there comes a time, hopefully, when they will be able to attach and sort of look at it. But there are some things, whether it's a police officer, anyone that has dealt with tremendous trauma and ugliness and violence in life, this is something that is very, very tough, because you do your best to go on. And many of them suffered from post-traumatic stress syndrome. They didn't have a clue about it at the time. They were told just to suck it up and have a stiff upper lip. And correct me if I'm wrong in what I've observed.
Yeah. Buck up and get on with your life,
That's right. Don't have time to cry over this.
Right. The veterans from World War II as a whole did a magnificent job of coming back to the United States as heroes, of course. That made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And finding their places in society and getting on with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, many of them, I talked to many men who didn't want to say one word.
Right.
You know, it's over, it's done with, I don't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's why
they're
called the silent generation.
Yes. And, of course, getting to know some of these fellows, I was able to talk to them not as an interviewer. They didn't want to see my pencil and my notebook. They just, they were willing to talk to me, but not if they thought I was taking notes. So what I was doing was gathering a feeling of what it was like to be a kid stuck in a situation where they're in mud up to their knees and it's raining and it's cold. And this is before ponchos and all the equipment that the soldiers might have today. They just got soaked through to the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cold, and they had to live like that without any decent food or warmth for months on end. It's amazing that any of them survived.
It really is. The war has always been an ugly proposition. Even
right.
with the sophistication we have today, I don't care. It is still dirty. It's still ugly. It's still horrific. Let's go back to your husband when he was 13 years of age, because your book, you wrote it something like a novel would be written, yet you've managed to capture in your writing the essence of the feelings of men. And I will tell you, not many women can do this. And it's nothing against women. It's very, very tough. It's just a fascinating thing that a woman like yourself was able to capture all of these emotions that many times are very, very difficult to have someone even talk about, much less be able to put it together in a format where you're feeling like you're right there. I mean, this is written from a male perspective, which I think is an incredible accomplishment for you as a writer. Let's go back to when he was 13. He had a real, real tough situation with his dad.
Yes, he did. His father had worked selling vegetables. He was what they used to call a huckster. He sold vegetables door to door. He had a horse and a cart. And he saved every nickel, every penny he could possibly save to set aside to bring his sister, to the United States. She was in Poland. And then, of course, 1929 rolled around.
Mm-hmm.
And the bank failed, and he lost every nickel. He had nothing left. And he became very bitter. He never worked another day in his life after that. He just gave up on the American way. He gave up on himself, actually.
Right.
And his poor wife, my husband's mother, and the children were forced to make do with next to nothing. And the father treated my husband almost like an opponent.
Mm-hmm.
They battled. It was a sense of will. It was a battle of who was the stronger of the two. And you can't even imagine a 13-year-old kid going through something like this today. But my husband never raised a finger to his father.
Mm-hmm.
He never touched him. And, of course, when my husband was a 13, 14-year-old kid, he was big and strong. He could have killed his father if he wanted
mm-hmm.
to.
That's true.
But he was always respectful, always remembered to honor his father and mother, and did so till the day they died. He was the kind of son that you read about in, as you say, in novels, but this really happened. This is the way he was. This is the way he is.
Well, now, I know
he's
that...
He's a very honorable person.
Mm-hmm. You talk about how his mother had to live, and she was the
yes.
one that
yes.
would go out and would beg, borrow, and do whatever she had to do to generate enough money so she at least
right.
could feed the family, because they were starving
right.
most of the time.
Right.
And then there was one day when your husband, along with some other boys, there had been a smashing of a store window, and they
mm-hmm.
went, and these were tough times. They went and helped themselves
with
some
tough.
Things, and
mm-hmm.
he took something home, a toaster for his mother.
An electric toaster.
An electric
that, of course,
toaster.
They
and,
had never even seen, yeah.
Right, and so he did, and his father saw it, and his father turned him into the police, and he ended up going to jail for this.
Yes.
So he had a very early age. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, so. And that was because his father could not tolerate the fact that his son had stolen something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the other kids all took something. The window had already been smashed. They didn't break the window. It had been smashed. But they, you know, they grabbed something from this broken store display. And no way would his father permit his son to get away with something like this. And he orchestrated his arrest. He, in fact, insisted on the arrest because the police would have been happy with giving the toaster back to the store.
Right, right. But his father did him a favor, actually, because by being in the reform school, he had an opportunity. He had finished eighth grade, but he was able to have access to a library that he literally devoured.
He devoured every book he could. Yeah.
This is someone who at a young age, even though he had been put into this situation, one, it did get him food every day. He was able to eat well.
He ate much better than he did at home.
That's right.
Yes.
And he had access to the library. There were teachers that came in to work with the kids. He took advantage of it. In fact, he ended up helping the teacher because he was so much more educated than the rest of the boys. So
that's right.
It's fascinating how life has its twists and turns, and that's something that you bring out in the book. Now, he went off to serve in the military at 17 years of age. I know of a number of people that lied about their age, and they weren't too scrupulous in checking a young man's age if they were fit and strong and healthy, and then they'd sign them up, and they went off to war.
Right. In those days, they just wanted someone who could fight.
That's right, and this was
serious
stuff.
They never checked. They never asked for parental permission. They just signed him up.
So he ends up going through the training, and it just is very intense. But I love the story that you had about a general when your husband was on the floor doing scrubbing, and the general comes by and instructs him on how to really clean the floor and how to do it easily with not so much stress. And your husband says, "Well, why don't you do it?"
He said, "Why don't you finish up the floors, mister?" He didn't know to call him sir. This was his very first day in the Army. He didn't know enough to call a general sir. He said, "Mister, why don't you finish up on the floor and I'll start in on the pots and pans." And, of course, the rest of the men were thoroughly convinced that my husband would be shot at sunrise the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, it was outrageous. But he was a kid. He didn't know. He didn't know any better. And I think he was not shot at sunrise the next morning because the general spotted all the tags still on his uniform. They came with not one tag, but dozens of tags stapled everywhere on every piece. Even his hat had tags on it. So the general knew he was green.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, the general did not have him shot, which was that's a very funny incident, I think, in the book. But,
it really is. Now, he became part of the 9th Division. And
No, no, you're absolutely right. He was with the 9th for over a year.
Mm-hmm. And they ended up going into an area close to Tunisia, and the Germans were there, and you give a wonderful description of what they were facing. And they had to face the enemy no matter how bad the situation was. And it was horrific. It was really horrific. Really horrific. And just the fact that they had been knowingly sent to this area and expected to die. They were not expected to survive. And they sort of surprised everybody with that.
Well, it was never called a suicide mission, but that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans had to protect their supplies, especially the fuel, because the Germans were running low and they were heading toward Eisenhower's headquarters where the supply depot was. And they didn't have an artillery unit to send in there. They were on their way, but time was of the essence, So they sent an artillery unit in without the benefit of infantry support, and these guys were outnumbered maybe 100 to 1. And the Germans were, there were so many of them, my husband, whenever we talk about this, he would say, there were so many, and we were so few.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he would describe it. And it was simply a miscalculation on Rommel's part that he thought there were more Americans there than there were, because the artillery just kept bombing and bombing and bombing. And Rommel pulled out,
mm-hmm.
thinking that he had no choice. And, of course, the Americans were down to maybe another 15 minutes of ammunition.
And then they would have been they would have been out. They would have been out, and they didn't know that.
Right.
So it was it was really like a bluff to the best of their capacity.
Yes.
That's what they did.
Yes.
And there's so much more detail about it. But you talk about the German well-oiled professional fighting machine, and then you talk about, you go into Patton and how your husband was so upset because he gave away their position. But what I really had a big surprise over when I got to this part is that your husband had unwittingly captured at least 100 stragglers from Mussolini's army who had been hiding out in a ravine. I mean, here is your husband out in, not even realizing, he tosses some things up, they blow up, and here are all these guys giving up, and he's going, who are you? And, we're part of Mussolini's army. Oh, really? Okay, fine. And they have a nice conversation, and he goes and he you know, takes them in. They were tired. These are people that have been fighting, and they didn't want to fight anymore.
No,
and so they said, okay, we give up. This is really, this would make a fabulous movie. It really would.
It would. It's, there's so many little things, that, you don't see this in most war stories. But this is what this poor kid went through. And what he picked up before he captured all those people from the Mussolini's army, they were Italian hand grenades. And I don't know if I described it well enough in the story, but Italian hand grenades are quite beautiful. They're colorful, not like the brown pineapple-shaped things that we see in movies that the Americans had. They were very colorfully designed. And my husband thought, he knew what they were, and he thought, wow, you know, he's a kid again. Let's throw a grenade and make a big noise.
Mm-hmm.
It was like more fun than skipping stones to throw these grenades into the ravine and hear the loud bang. And, of course, the next thing, all these dusty soldiers from the Italian army are coming with waving their white handkerchiefs.
And they all speak English. And he recognizes one that has a Brooklyn accent. And he said,
and it was because...
Yeah,
they were from Brooklyn.
They were from Brooklyn. They were Americans fighting because they were Italians. They had gone back to Italy, had become part of the Italian army that was under Mussolini. So, I mean, here's this conversation going on. It's just a phenomenal, phenomenal experience. Well, then he goes into a number of, different stories about how, what they had to survive. You talk about the winter of 1943. And
terrible
time. Soldiers, I mean, this is portrayed in a lot of the documentaries for that year. It was horrific conditions. And he did something that kept him from getting trench foot, which was really fascinating. Barbasol shaving cream. And he shared that with everybody that was interested, but he never got it, which is amazing because the men got the trench foot because they were in water, were in filthy conditions. And just, they couldn't keep anything clean. There was no way. They didn't have dry cleaners or, you know, laundromats handy.
They didn't even have clean water.
Right. Just absolutely unbelievable. There's a lot of his emotion in here and his feeling, and the details I think are so great. But when he walked in to Auschwitz, that was...
No, Dachau.
Dachau, I beg your pardon, Dachau.
Yeah.
That was an experience that, as long as he would live, he would never, ever forget that.
He sees it every time he closes his eyes. It's imprinted mm-hmm. in his thinking, in his thoughts, in his soul. I mean, you don't forget something like that. You just don't.
That's right, you don't. And he was one of the first groups that went in, and he was all of 20 years of age.
He was 20 years old.
And there were camera crews following him. And he goes into it, and when the soldiers, the American soldiers, saw what was there in Dachau, it wasn't something in their wildest dreams they could have imagined that human beings could do to other human beings.
No. And, you know, by this time, they all hated the Nazis anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, they couldn't believe that even the Nazis could be that cruel. They
mm-hmm.
couldn't believe what they were seeing before their eyes. And especially my husband, being a Jew,
mm-hmm.
was totally, totally demoralized. He was very helpful, though, because back in Pittsburgh, as a kid, his first language was Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
Because his mother was from Russia, his father was from Poland. They did not speak each other's languages, so they communicated in Yiddish, as most Jews did in the old days.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my husband's first language before he went to school and learned English. And he spoke to these poor souls. They weren't all from Germany. Some were from Hungary. Some were from Poland. And he communicated with the prisoners, the Dachau prisoners, in Yiddish, so he could tell the medical people what they needed
mm-hmm.
or what they wanted or, you know, just what their names were, for heaven's sakes. It was for a 20-year-old kid to go through this with prisoner after prisoner talking to them in Yiddish, trying to get them to understand that it's over. It's going to be okay now. We're here to rescue. They didn't want to believe that. They'd been
mm-hmm.
lied to so many times, they couldn't believe it. But my husband tried to tell them that the Americans had come to save them.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them died before they got them out of the building they were in.
Right.
They were so, so, so badly beaten and starved. It was just the most unbelievable experience that any young man could ever have to endure.
There was a man that had a very strong impact on your husband. His name was Raymond Deacon. And
Raymond Deacon.
He said that he wanted Rosen to go to college, to get a higher education.
Yes.
He wanted him to understand the value of education. And after Dachau and the heroics that he had gone through, and he got medals for it, and he was then eligible for discharge. However, his colonel wanted him to take a commission as a second lieutenant. He wanted him to go to the Far East to go and get involved in the war in the Pacific. But because of Raymond Deacon, your husband said, no, I'm not going to do that. He had grown up in 3 years of living in these horrific conditions and seeing and experiencing what he had, he realized that he wanted more in life. And all of his dreams, I don't know that he really had gigantic dreams because he was so young when he went in, but just about all of the men that he had an association with that did survive the war, just like you said earlier when we started talking about this, they wanted to leave the horror and the devastation behind. So he turned away from the commission and decided he was going to go home and he was going to go back to school. And that is exactly what he did. And by the time it was all said and done and finished and he was on his way home, he had turned, just 21, hadn't he?
Well, he didn't turn 21 until he was actually back on the U.S. soil.
Okay.
He was 20 when he flew home.
When he flew home, just close to 21 years of age. Now, he's in his 70s at this time.
No. He will be 85.
Oh, ho, 85.
In about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, he will be have his 85th birthday.
Okay, October. I beg your pardon. He retired at 71. That's my
yes, he retired.
He retired at 71. Yes. But he went on, even though he'd only had an eighth grade education, because of his love of reading and everything he did, they just gave him a college exam, and he passed it, and he went to L.A. City College. He got a job at the United States Embassy in Paris, and he stayed there for 5 years deciphering codes. He earned a bachelor's degree in English, a master's degree in school administration, worked as an elementary school teacher and as an acting elementary school principal. He got his master's degree, went into investment, and 23 years after being in the investment area, he retired at 71, which we mentioned. This is a man who proved that no matter what your circumstances are, you can rise above them. Your book, which I think is awesome, A Kid from Pittsburgh. Marion, I just think you've done an incredible job with your husband's story.
Well,
you
thanks.
Have a website, and that website is marionrosen.com, and it's M-A-R-I-O-N Rosen, R-O-S-E-N. It's a story that I think should be read to teenagers. I think that it's something that anyone that reads it will have a glimpse of what life was like then. We have just about 30 seconds here. Is there something you'd like to close out with in the way of a statement regarding what you've done, Marion, about your husband?
Well, I did not want to deal with battle tactics or the viewpoints of generals or anything of that sort. I wanted to transcend that kind of thing and just tell the story of one soldier, a boy, actually, who grew up doing what was right during a time that was really very wrong because of Hitler and his insanity. You know, so many men came out above that and proved themselves to be really the greatest generation.
Very true. Again, they're known typically as a silent generation. History speaks volumes, and when it's written from the heart, from a perspective of integrity and honesty, it really can make an impact. And that's what Marion Rosen has done with her publication, A Kid from Pittsburgh. Go and check out her website, marionrosen.com. Marion, it's been a pleasure having you as a guest. Continue
thank
your
you,
writing
thank you
and be
much.
Sure and let me know when your next book
I
comes
will.
Out. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking our break. We'll be back in just a moment.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to DTaP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. Telephone lines are now open, 818-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Now, if you're a first-time listener and you would like to call in and chat to me with me, all I need is your first name or your initial. And then after that, sit back, relax, let me find out what I can perceive for you, and then you can ask me a question about anything that you like. So again, telephone lines for the next half hour are open, 888-815-9756. I don't know about you, but sometimes, have you ever felt like you were stuck? You just, like your creative juices just were not working, and you just feel like you've got a brain fog you don't know how to cut through. Well, I came across some good suggestions, and I thought I'd pass them along to you. Now, maybe you have heard them before, but I always think it's a good idea to be able to recognize that even though you might be in a mental funk, you can do some things that will clear that fog out, that mental peanut butter kind of feel, and then get your mental juices going. Now, I don't know about you, but fatigue sometimes is my biggest adversary. And if I am wise, when I get extremely fatigued, then what I will do is take a nap or find some place where at least I can just be quiet, close my eyes, and allow my brain to go into a down mode. Have you ever been so busy mentally that you just think, if I have to think of one more thing, I feel like I'm just going to absolutely explode because nothing is working. I'm just getting nothing but a jumbled mess. Well, here are some tips. And if you have someone you can brainstorm with, lots of times that's help. But when you're on your own and you're all by yourself, one of the simplest things you can ever do is take a break. Go out for a walk, do something in your garden, and just sort of put whatever your concern might be up in the front of your mind and just say, okay, I'm letting it go. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. And when you sort of detach and you get involved in something physically, then what evolves is the brain goes places and ideas might pop in that if you were just sitting trying to force it to happen, it would not happen for you. So you can literally walk away and become refreshed. I used to do that years ago when I was working as an executive secretary. On my lunch hour, I didn't try to have lunch with anybody. I would just, because of all the interaction that was going on in the office, I would go out and I would put myself into an environment. And at the time when I was in the job, there had been a brand new shopping mall that had developed. And I would just go and walk, and I'd look at all the things, and I'd just leave everything in the office behind. It was wonderful. And I'd come back, and I felt so good. And I can remember someone saying, how come you're always in such a good mood? But I had to be deliberate about doing that, because if I just did the standard stuff that everybody else did, I just wasn't able to function. I would be dragging at mid-afternoon, and my work was just not very, very efficient. Also, something they found that when people go into the internet, that's also a break, and if you want to type terms into Google, I had not heard of this, and I thought this is a good idea, typing terms into Google that are unrelated to a particular problem in a way to generate ideas. Now, this suggestion came from Roger Firestein, who's the president of Innovation Resources in Buffalo, New York. He said, if you're thinking of ways to attract more clients and type barn door into the search engine, the results could trigger ideas like hold a barn dance for clients or paint your brochures red or let's have animals at an event. And this is what he said. And I thought, okay, that it's amazing what can trigger a concept that will work. And he said, it's okay if thoughts are wacky. You can take some of those ridiculous ideas and you can make them better. And I remember a gentleman that I interviewed a couple of years ago that said he had developed a process with companies, and he went around working with them. When there was a problem, they would get out huge whiteboards, and they would gather the people around that were to do the brainstorming and say, okay, what's your idea? What do we do? And people would just give ideas and give ideas and give ideas, and some of them were so wacky it was unbelievable. However, what occurred is that in the brainstorming with the group, all of a sudden, an idea would pop out of what seemed to be the most ridiculous, stupid statement that had been made, because people were just sort of winding down, burning out, and they just said, enough is enough, and they'd come up with these wacky things, and all of a sudden somebody had an aha. And it was because of the cooperative effort of everyone. Well, you don't always have that when you are a loner. So there may be times of the day when your creative juices work better than others. I'm an early morning kind of a person. Also, if you make a point of writing ideas down when they come in to you, if you have a little journal, you can do this. Steve Allen, the phenomenal entertainer, he did that all the time. He had pads of paper all over the house, and he'd write things down. He'd get ideas for books, for shows. They'd pop in, he'd just write them down. He never, ever put down any concepts that came to him. And so consequently, he was one of the most creative people ever known in show business. He was absolutely amazing. And nothing was too outrageous. And when you do this journaling, it creates that creative flow. And he said, it's amazing how this can happen. And also, lots of times, having books available that you can just go in, books are like friends to me. When you have a good library, when you're able to work with a library, and you have things, maybe you just go in and you pick something out at random, a book calls to you, and you pull it out and you start reading it, and you go, wow, this is a good idea, and it may incorporate something with those creative juices that you've been frustrated that haven't been flowing very well for you. So those are just some tips. If you find you need to do some brainstorming, you do need to get those creative juices going, I think those are a few good suggestions that you might enjoy. Also, another one, why not give me a call if you'd like to chat? If you've got some challenges that you're facing, call me at 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756, and I'll be delighted to give you my perception. We're going to take a break. When we come back, again, phone lines are open, 888-815-9756. More good things to share. We'll be right back.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedros. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-815-9756. Do you wear glasses? I have. In fact, I probably should have had them when I was 2 years old. But it wasn't until the sixth grade that it was discovered that my vision was atrociously bad. Well, your eyes are so special. And if you wear glasses like I do, you know you have to go in and you have to have your eyes checked every so often because the vision does change. As you get older, you are going to be finding your vision is fairly stable. Well, apparently it is so important today more than ever before to really be cognizant of taking care of your vision. And one of the reasons is because we are working so much with computers. And this goes for people of all ages. I know I have a special set of glasses that I have to wear when I'm on the computer because my regular glasses just, I will get a splitting headache. In fact, I won't be able to work on the computer if I use my regular glasses. So this is something a lot of people are finding. And those of you that are 65 or older, about one-third of that population of that age group have some kind of a sight-impairing disease. And most of these vision problems are preventable. Now, by the time you turn 40, all adults should have screening for eye disease. And sometimes those diseases can be taken care of very, very readily. Glaucoma, diabetic retinopathy, cataracts, and also nearsightedness, farsightedness, astigmatism. You've all got all of these things. And if you have anything like diabetes, high blood pressure, things like this, you need to have your eyes checked. The eyes, as it is so often stated, are the vision, are the that which sees or shows the soul. And it's really very true. When I was growing up, I had a wonderful eye doctor. And Dr. Bloom, I know he's passed on, but he was such a fine, fine physician. He said, Donna, the eyes show the total physical condition of the body. Now, some of you may be aware of a wonderful level of knowledge called iridology. Well, there's a good, strong basis for it. And for someone who is very skilled and experienced with it, they can really see a lot of things regarding nutrition, etc. Well, your eye doctor, if he's well trained, is also going to be able to give you information about your general health. So this is something that having your eyes checked really is a very inexpensive way of being able to know your health conditioning. And when you have that eye exam, be sure that they do the dilation of the eyes so that they can get that inside look. If there's weakened blood vessels, if there is symptom of perhaps of diabetes or some other conditions, the eyes will show it. Now, if you are working with a computer screen for long hours, 50 to 90% of workers right now today in today's world who use video display terminals have eye discomfort. And reduced performance is the consequence of this situation. So this is what is recommended by people who have been doing a lot of research regarding working with terminals. Adjust your monitor to increase contrast and make text larger. Try to remember to blink frequently. When you stare at a computer screen, you don't typically blink, and then your eyes become very, very dry. Remember, blinking is what brings moisture to the eye itself. So this will cause dry eyes. And you can use artificial tears to reduce the dryness, but if you can move your eyes every 20 minutes, away from your screen. And if you can look out of a window where your eyes can get some rest, or if you have a photograph or something that you can have nearby your screen, that is really, really good. Now, for those of you who may have employees, make sure employees use protective eyewear whenever they're using tools or chemicals. This is something that is absolutely mandatory. You also want to have fact sheets, which you can get for free, from Prevent Blindness America and encourage them to have an eye screening exam. You also, if you have staff that works on computers all day long, you want to encourage them to take a break. When computer workers take 4 extra 5-minute breaks during the workday, they're far more productive. And that means getting up out of your chair, maybe stretching, moving, but you get yourself away from that computer. Maybe it's a good idea just to use a timer. I've done that. Set a timer because I'll have no sense of time when I'm doing computer work. Also, you might want, if you're an employer, to consider providing those employees that are on computers all the time computer glasses. And they're designed for focusing on a monitor at arm's length and can reduce eye strain. There was a 2004 University of Alabama study that found that those computer users who wore glasses with improper correction were not as efficient in their computer work. So the use of computer glasses more than pays for the cost of the eyewear. These are just some real good tips that I think you should be aware of because all of us are involved with it, and I know with me, sometimes I even put my sunglasses on. That sounds a little crazy, but I'll put them on because of different material I'm looking at. If I do not have enough illumination in the room around me, the glare just is impossible for me to work with. So think of that. That may be something that'll be helpful to you too. It may look a little strange, but if it works, who cares? This is Donna Siebel, and I know we're just about out of time. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about horses. Horses with a mission. Linda Anderson is going to be my guest, and I'm so looking forward to this because I absolutely love horses, and if you do too, you're going to thoroughly enjoy the stories we're going to be sharing with you. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Regardless of what life throws at you, you have the opportunity to use it as leverage to make you move ahead with a dynamic purpose, or you can shut yourself up in a dark room of fear. Don't do the latter. Do the former, because life is for living, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing to do. This is Donna Siebel. We'll be back with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on BBSRadio.com. Station 1. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.